Welcome to Smith Weekly Discussions, an occasional program for our members of Smith Weekly Research. Please note this program is a private discussion and everything contained herein is for entertainment and educational purposes only. With that, we hope you're in a comfortable position, along with your favorite beverage, to enjoy the discussion. We remind our audience to examine our show notes attached to each of our shows to better understand how our program functions. Before we get into our discussion, we want to say thanks for questions coming from our audience at Smith Weekly, including Luke A., Mark R., Ryan S., Nick W., and Brent S. We have a returning guest on the program today. Miss Judith Curry is back on the show. Judith is the president and co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, a weather and climate consultancy that assists various types of businesses make decisions around impacts of weather and climate on their products and services. Judith is former chair, School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Georgia Institute of Technology. She is also an author of the book, Climate, Uncertainty, and Risk. You can learn more about Judith and her work by visiting her website, judithcurry.com, as well as by visiting the website of Climate Forecast Applications Network, cfanclimate.net. Ms. Curry, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Delighted to be back.
Yes, absolutely. Always looking forward to having you back and really appreciate you accepting our request to have you come back on. So great to chat here. Judy, we have a lot to talk about, and I don't think we're going to cover everything with this episode, but we can at least get through some of it. I'd like to start just a little bit differently here at the beginning and talk about your business first. For example, here in 2022, CFAN was recognized by the Energy Business Review magazine for work to assist the energy trading market. Just talk about that as one example of the type of work you do.
Okay, well, following the hurricanes, you know, Katrina and all that mess in 2005 in the Gulf of Mexico, natural gas prices went crazy anytime there was, you know, a hurricane. So natural gas trading of futures was implemented to help stabilize gas prices. And that worked pretty well, you know, with the hurricanes and everything. And energy trading actually got pretty boring until wind farms entered the scene with the intermittency of wind power production that needs to be filled in with natural gas. So there's a lot of spot trading, futures trading, and whatever. So ironically, wind farms and solar farms has rejuvenated natural gas trading. And this depends on what the traders use is forecasts of demand, you know, related to temperature and weather, and also anticipated wind power and solar power production. So that's one of the things that my company does, not to mention forecasting hurricanes, which is sort of also a big issue for natural gas.
Yeah, Judy, that's great. And I just have to laugh a little bit here. Sometimes there was a publication, and I'll have to forgive me for exactly what publication it was, but this was an image that another very prominent person in the climate community had put out about some of these folks had actually gotten the rotation of the hurricane incorrect in their imagery that they produced. And so you bring up hurricanes, so I got to laugh about that one. We got to bring that back in a moment because I want to talk about some of this other stuff that relates to that in a second. But I want to stay on the business part, which is one example, as you said there, and it goes right into what I was going to ask you. This example that you gave of the services you would provide to clients, but also maybe even assisting a mining company, for example, with weather prediction services that would assist them in making decisions at, say, an open pit conventional mine operation with a tailings storage facility, for example, obviously related to rainfall, you know, down to other things, which, again, coming back to what you said, this is a bit of a fun one, helping a wind or solar company that's in wind and solar energy determine based on weather research and prediction that your firm provides to maybe put heating systems on their projects to partially protect from freezing temperature, ice, snow events, because of course, Judy, as we well know, these sources of energy are so fragile, among other things. But would that be another one that we would potentially have as an example here in terms of your expertise to predict these events so they can take precautions?
Well, I mean, there's several timescales that are involved here. Like on the shorter timescales, there could be a big event like a hurricane. So we have a number of electric utilities in the Southeast US who use our forecast to anticipate a week in advance a possible threat to their region so they can start putting various emergency management protocols into play. And this helps minimize the outages and speed up the restoration of power, you know, following the hurricane. So that's an important role for the short-term forecast. At longer term, like hardening infrastructure, we do consulting for energy companies, you know, everything from petroleum companies to electric utilities to, you know, figure out, you know, over the next 25 years or so, what kind of extreme weather threats might they be facing? How can they, you know, harden their infrastructure, implement, you know, new information technologies and better emergency management protocols? So we help them anticipate some scenarios of what might happen in the coming decades. And, you know, people think it's just the slow creep of warming. Well, no, there's a lot of natural weather and climate variability that really dominates things on the timescales of a few decades. And, you know, the slow creep of warming gets lost in that noise on a timescale of a few decades.
Absolutely. And you and I have talked about this in the past, just with respect to some people can't even remember what they did last weekend. And so you pretty much can't even start to put the context around multiple decades without obviously good data collection and then the understanding, almost like a geologist's perspective of how things form and the time it takes. Well, we can't really conceptualize that well without training and discipline to understand that us living for lucky 80 years on this earth and how weather events and climate evolves over thousands of years, and in the case, 10,000s of years or whatever the number is. So I really appreciate your comments on that. I want to move on here. So I think there's a good context. I think there's a number of applications, energy, mining. There's so many things here that your company can do to help assist companies in economically viable ways for them to protect the infrastructure, as you said, prevent catastrophic failures of infrastructure and these types of things, and obviously disasters that could ensue from a flood event where it wasn't mitigated properly. Lots of good examples there as to how you can help potential clients. Before we get into some specific areas of discussion here, Judy, we're midway through 2024. In your view, because you've been looking at this for a long period of time, many decades for yourself, how has the climate change narrative evolved more recently, as you've witnessed and experienced this over many decades, of course, through former names, of course, like, you know, global warming would be one of a number of them. But just in the last couple of years, Judy, has it been successful for the perpetrators of the narrative, or is it becoming more challenged now as people start to do more work? What are you seeing now, and how are you seeing this evolve?
Well, over the last 2 years, I mean, ironically, in spite of the rhetoric, you know, from Code Red and the Highway to Hell. I don't know what their latest words are, but they're pretty alarming. Nevertheless, even the UN has dropped the most alarming warming scenarios. And now they're talking about maybe another degree and a half centigrade of warming by 2100, which is about, you know, essentially what we've seen already over the last 100 years. So this is nothing, you know, terribly alarming. We've already adapted to the warming that we've seen. But nevertheless, they continue to amp up the rhetoric because they are so, there's a certain worldview that regards humans as a blight on the planet. And the biggest part of that blight is their use of fossil fuels. So they, you know, come hell or high water, they want to get rid of those fossil fuels. But, you know, climate is increasingly becoming not a very good justification for that, because in 2023, we saw a big temperature spike for combination of reasons. I mean, the slow creep of global warming can't explain a temperature spike like that. But we did breach the 1.5 degree centigrade threshold that they say is absolutely alarming. But, you know, nothing bad happened. It was even a relatively benign weather year as far as weather goes in 2023. So, you know, people say, okay, what's the alarm? And now there's, particularly in Europe, there's a big backlash against all of this. The recent EU elections, I mean, the Greenish parties lost a lot of seats and a lot of votes. we're seeing in England and France, the rise of the so-called fringe opposition parties, if you will, largely because the populace is just so sick of, this narrative of austerity and expensive energy that is associated with climate change. And it seems, it's very detrimental to their well-being, and they're not seeing, like, why should we care about this? So I think we reached peak craziness around 2021, 2022. And I think there's starting to be a backlash politically, and the population is just starting to care about other things and to ignore this issue. I think it's heading in the right direction. I mean, sure, we need to worry about our environment and not endlessly dump garbage into the atmosphere, but we need to put all this into perspective, and we need to keep human well-being, as our primary objective. Not some sort of arbitrary metric for health of the planet or something.
Yes, at the end of the day, we all know it's not for the health of the planet. It's a complete lie, because if you if it was for the health of the planet, you would say, well, why are we doing these things under the guise of basically climate? We could come into a couple examples there. I mean, I'll just use one. I very, very much against the industrial scale use of wind and solar, very much against it. And when you see that trying to be propagated in this belief that we can live off wind and solar on an industrial scale, this is what the context here, that somehow everything is better, I just don't follow the logic. Really silly. That's one example. We don't need to get into others because we actually have limited time, but there's many others, as you and I both know, Judy. But I want to hold that for a moment because I want to get on to another topic, and we'll come back into that as we discuss. So it'll come up a few times as we talk here. Lake Chad. A body of water that at one time covered the borders with Chad, Nigeria, Niger, and Cameroon. This has nearly been eliminated and is a small fraction of what it used to be. Tell us the story on Lake Chad.
Well, in the 60s and 70s, there was a big drought in the region. Okay. And, the lake started to dry up. And then the circulation patterns changed. And there's been plenty of rain in the region for the last several decades. Nevertheless, the lake continues to dry out. It's not related to a lack of rainfall, it's related to everybody siphoning water off from the lake to irrigate their rice farms, which require a lot of water. And so, in the region, you have some very low productivity, inefficient rice farms, but this is nevertheless sucking up all the water in Lake Chad. Okay, so how do people, the politicians in the region say, oh, they blame it on climate change? That way it's not their fault. They can get aid from, the international agencies, and it takes the blame off them. So rather than confronting their real problems, which is their water management and using a huge amount of water to irrigate these very inefficient and ineffective rice farms, they're blaming it on climate change instead. It's an excuse for any problem that we face. Oh, just throw up your hands and blame it on climate change. That allows us to cover up for poor governance and gives us, an out for actually confronting our real problems and trying to address them in meaningful ways.
I think the Nile River as well has a number of issues. There's obviously some hydroelectric ambitions with certain areas in the Nile. It's shared by different countries, of course. So there's always the fight and squabbling about people upstream, downstream, and everybody else, right? And I want to tie this Lake Chad issue over to Lake Mead, which you're well familiar with. Again, another story on mismanagement, or is this a climate change excuse? What are your thoughts on Lake Mead?
Well, Lake Mead has been replenished fairly significantly over the last few years. So there is a certain amount of natural weather and climate variability that's going to cause the lake to go up and down. But the sad issue is that we're just using too much water in the US Southwest. Population, in mega cities like Phoenix and Las Vegas is huge. Las Vegas has been actually quite good at minimizing its use of water. But I remember being in Phoenix, and this is going to be like maybe 15 years ago, and everybody had green lawns. And, talking about people, it's like asking people to conserve water. It was like, trying to take away their guns or something. It was just part of their freedom, to use water however they want it. I think Phoenix is getting a little bit more realistic, but there are, people in the Southwest US just have to get real about water. Now, the good news is that desalination of seawater is becoming increasingly inexpensive, and like countries like Dubai, live completely off of desalinated seawater. So, off the coast of California and, the Baja region and whatever, there the region does have access to seawater. So that is a potential solution for the region. But until, they bite the bullet and do something like that, they have to confront that their water resources are limited and they're vulnerable to natural weather and climate variability, as well as the slow creep of global warming, which I think is probably having a drying effect in that region. Although globally, global warming causes more rainfall, but not necessarily in that region. It was really, really low for a while, but it's bounced back quite a bit with several years of decent wintertime rains.
Good to get your opinion on that and get what is happening there with that. It's just overall your view of it because it aligns right with what we've seen too, in the same sense. And of course, terrible amount of mismanagement. But of course, that mismanagement is just covered. Said, well, it's climate change. Everything today is an excuse. Ah, it's just climate change, and it's a complete farce of crap. A couple things you mentioned there, a discussion around water rights, and one of the most important things I think coming out specifically in the US is water rights in the future. I think water's going to be a tremendous heated issue and the rights thereof in the years to come. And then, of course, desalination, you hit it right on the head. I have to shake my head and say, why has desalination been so suppressed in specific places like the United States for such a long period of time when we've seen it successful in so many other applications in different countries, in mining applications in the Atacama region of northern Chile? It has been commercially successful and viable for a long time, yet we've refused in our laziness to do anything about it in the Southwest. And I think that's the real issue here on that. It's funny you said, Arizona and Phoenix, Scottsdale. It's funny, everybody's got green lawns in a desert. Anyway, it's always a good one to cover off there, but desalination, a huge fan of desalinization, the benefits that you can do with that. Let's stop on that and move on here and talk about notable weather events. And this ties into my next question. But first, wasn't there a significant period, Judy, of temperature increases, drought, and hurricanes during the 1930s, specifically in the US? And let me couple this. Was it regionalized or was it a global occurrence?
Well, there were global elements to it. It was region, both in the US and Europe, Eurasia, saw, extreme weather. It was, a string of La Niñas. It was, favorable ocean circulation pattern, or rather, to cause these weather. And this was a decade-long thing in the 30s. It was, we had the worst drought and heat waves in the US, bad forest fires, but there were forest fires really in all of the decades of the early 20th century, much worse than anything that, we've seen in recent decades. It wasn't just about heat and dry. There was also the two worst US landfalling hurricanes occurred in the 1930s. And this is when global temperatures were more than a degree Fahrenheit cooler than what they are. So, I mean, this is just an example that extreme weather events don't scale very well with global average surface temperature.
I appreciate the comments on that. Just to add some additional context for people who aren't looking beyond just the last decade or what have you. So it's good to get real context here and have some other information come in here for people to consider. As you know, there have been a number of people that have been led to believe there has been an increase significantly beyond historic or even recent past records of wildfire, drought, flooding, hurricanes, etc. I'd like to have you address this and perhaps maybe if you have a couple specific examples on this as to if that data is valid or misrepresented.
Okay, you don't have to look very far back, to find more extreme weather events than what we've seen in recent decades. I'll give you an example. Everyone's heard of atmospheric rivers, those big storms that come in to the US West Coast and dump a huge amount of rain and snow, and even cause some flooding. Well, the worst atmospheric river in history was in the winter of 1861 to 62, when a series of these atmospheric river events hit Northern California over a period of about 2.5 months, and the Central Valley of California was underwater by 10 feet. Okay, and this lasted, for months before that, water dissipated and ran off and was absorbed into the ground. And sediment analysis showed that that wasn't the worst one. There were several worse ones, say a couple hundred years before that. So about every, 200 years or so, there have been a huge, huge atmospheric river event like that that causes tons of flooding in Northern California. So, the things that we've seen in recent decades is nothing compared to that. So that's an example where you don't have to look all that far back to find a much worse weather event than what we're seeing right now.
Any comments on wildfire or hurricanes?
Okay, well, wildfires, in the if you read, I mean, wildfires and smoke was just characterized the US West, in the 1800s and early 1900s. I mean, that was just smoke in the summertime. I mean, that's just what it was. Things were burning like crazy. I mean, it was just burning, burning, burning everywhere. And there were some huge fires. I think the biggest one was one that impacted Montana. I'm thinking 1910. It was huge in terms of, I mean, just absolutely huge, much bigger, like order of magnitude than anything that we've seen in recent decades. And actually, following that big Montana one, that was interesting because this is when, the government, the Department of the Interior decided, we can't let these fires get out of hand. So they entered, a decades-long period of attempting to suppress fires, which worked quite well, except there was so much, trees and wood building up that, you're going to pay that debt at some point. There's a big fire debt, that those forests were owed that we're in the middle of right now repaying that debt because there's just the landscape and the climate and whatever, can't really support so many trees. So it's allowing nature to run its course, is a good idea for nature, but we've got a lot of people living in the way, so we have to manage our forests carefully. And this includes prescribed burns and thinning of forests and not having transmission grid. If somebody wants to live out in the boonies like that, we can't have transmission grids supplying electricity to them because those same transmission grids are going to spark fires. So, people have to generate their electricity locally if they're going to live in those regions. So we just have to be more sensible about how we manage the forests and what kind of support and regulations we're going to have to impose on people who want to live in these very fire-prone regions. So, but yeah, no, forest fires were just horrendous. Now that I'm tuned into it, when I read, books from that era, people always talking about the smoke. It was just part of the climate in the entire US West. It was always on fire.
Judy, so I've got a few things, and I want to talk to you about hurricanes in just a moment and get your idea
Good.
or get your
Favorite.
thoughts on hurricanes. Yes, I want to come back to that, but hold on a sec because I want to download a few things here. That fire was 1910, Great Fire of 1910 for the audience reference. Go look it up, do some work. With your comments on the fires, first of all, the transmission lines, I know a little bit about this because I'm from that area. The transmission lines there, generally, first and foremost, putting transmission underground, so distribution underground, makes a lot of sense. And generally, that can work pretty well in a lot of cases. Not everywhere, of course, there's stuff that has to be mitigated on that front, but in certain areas, that can make some sense. On top of that, what I have seen, and this is firsthand experience, is the regulations from the agencies, Judy, have specifically caused and inhibited transmission to be properly maintained because of an endangered species, some nest, some snail, some bird, some wetland, whatever. Overgrowth has happened throughout our forest terribly. So it goes back to mismanagement. And of course, that mismanagement has led to fires, not by lightning strike, but by transmission potential spark. And you have those issues. Then it doesn't take a history major to figure this one out. Look at arson. Arson is really, really straightforward. And arson has been with us throughout human history. Arson is in every society. And there's lots of historic books on arson. You can look at arson in Russia. You can look at lots of different things here. Let's just say what it is. There's an industry out there, obviously, that benefits from these things. And there's obviously a narrative that benefits from arson. And so I'm going to add that to the list as well, because without a doubt, I'm convinced that arson is also part of even recent events as well. So there's that piece. And let me just add one more thing, and then I'd love your comments, would be that a very experienced person, highly regarded in the community, very experienced, lived in the region whole life, the Southern Oregon region, told me that living in that period of time, even I was not able to witness the flooding, the heavy snowfall, if you want to call it extreme weather. I'm not sure I would, but anyway, during the period of the 1960s through the late 80s, early 90s, don't even compare to the lessening amount of floods and weather events that are even happening in the last couple of decades. So what he's saying is it was worse in that region. And this is, we're talking Southern Oregon, Northern California. And that comes from people that have actually lived there and experienced it. Those are my comments back on it. And then I want to move to hurricanes and also get your comments.
Okay, well, one quick comment on the fires. The tragic fires in Hawaii that happened a little while back. Apparently, what happened is that the electric companies were ignoring vegetation management and diverting all that personnel into installing wind turbines. So they neglected the vegetation management in favor of trying to install renewable energy. And then they blame it on climate change. Well, yeah, in that case, it's probably true. You can blame it on policies that are trying to prevent climate change. So that's another example. But on to hurricanes. There's a lot of year-to-year variability in the hurricanes that we see in the Atlantic region. And since 1995, we've been in an active period associated with the Atlantic circulation patterns. There were a few decades, the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, that were really quiet in terms of hurricanes. So if you start drawing a trend line from 1970 to now, it looks like there's an increase. But then if you go back to the 1930s and the 1950s, that was another active period. And there were, this really big hurricanes, a lot of hurricanes, a lot of major hurricanes, and the worst US landfalling hurricanes are still back from that earlier era. So there's a number of theories as to how and why hurricanes should be getting worse, but the only one that seems to hold water for me, literally, is that as the sea surface temperatures warm, these storms can carry more water, and so you're getting some heavier rainfalls associated with these hurricanes. But in terms of wind speed, any signal that we're getting stronger hurricanes, there just doesn't seem to be any evidence of that. And ironically, climate models actually predict fewer hurricanes in a warmer climate. So that seems sort of surprising. So there's no reason to think that hurricanes are getting worse, other than possibly in some regions like the Gulf of Mexico, maybe we're seeing more rain coming with these hurricanes. But in terms of intensity and overall damage, not really. Once you scale all this for population increase and GDP and all these other things that you need to scale out, you don't really see any trends. And actually, the worst landfalling hurricane in terms of damage still continues to be the Great Miami Hurricane of 1926. So it's hard to argue that hurricanes are getting worse. They aren't really. Right now in the Atlantic, we are in an active phase, and we could, continue to be in that phase for another decade or so. But the big issue is, if you even if you go back to 1970, the population density in Florida was way lower than what it is now. Yeah, I mean, it's just increased insanely since about, well, since the 1970s. And whenever I fly into Florida, like into Miami Airport, and you see the coast, and it looks like inches away from the coast, there's all these high-rise buildings. I said, oh my gosh, these things are just waiting to be toppled over like dominoes. But they do have very stringent building codes in the state of Florida, which are really good. The only issue, I mean, after, well, I guess it was Wilma in 92, which again hit Miami. That's when Florida got really serious about building codes. So, buildings that were built before 92 are obviously not built to those codes, but the more recent ones being built to withstand hurricane winds and even the flooding. So Florida is really being very proactive. The other state that gets clobbered by hurricanes, well, there's actually Louisiana and Texas. Texas really doesn't have any building codes at all. They just take it and get hit. You walk down in Houston, there isn't any green to be seen. The entire city's covered in cement. They're crazy vulnerable to flooding. They're trying to get real. I mean, their solution, they're building a big Galveston seawall. I can't remember how many billions have now been allocated to that, to build a big seawall to help protect Houston and Galveston from hurricanes. And I think that's a good investment given that there's so much wealth and infrastructure in Houston that's vulnerable to water. I mean, the winds are one thing, but I think water is the big vulnerability. And back in the day, the first time I visited the Florida Keys, and this had to be, I guess, in the 1980s, I mean, there was just a bunch of shacks. There were no big high rises, no expensive buildings. They said, and the rationale was, well, every 20 years or so, it all gets blown down and then we rebuild it. And that makes sense. You go to the Florida Keys now, and it looks like Miami Beach with the high rises, the condos, and the hotels, and everything. And I go, oh my gosh. But it's relatively recent construction. I hope it's, fairly hardy to the wind damage. But the water damage is what gets you. Even with this new construction, and this was, I guess, the most recent big landfall was on, Fort Myers Beach, and this was Hurricane Ian 2 years ago. And they had a crazy storm surge. It was like a 16-foot storm surge that went through Fort Myers Beach and, just blew out a lot of stuff. And there were some, new hotels that were just being built and hadn't been occupied. And you look at them structurally from the outside and they go, wow, it looked like these did great. But they got salt water into the elevator infrastructure. Okay. And then the elevators were inoperable. So, they had to, just take out and redo and all this stuff just because of the elevators. I guess that was an unanticipated vulnerability. But for Fort Myers Beach is, rebuilt a lot to much stricter building codes. My sister lives down there, so I'm kept up to date on that one. And so now they'll be less vulnerable to the next one that comes around. People want to live in these locations. I mean, they're lovely, they're beautiful, but they're very vulnerable. And there's two choices. The old style Florida Keys approach, where you just build shacks and expect it to be blown over every so often, or build really strong buildings. And so
Right.
Southern Florida seems to be going the route of building really strong buildings. So, that's one of the things, there's different ways to adapt. We've always had hurricanes, and we have them now, and we'll have them in the future. And even if they were to get a tiny bit worse with global warming, we would barely notice it, in the noise, of natural variability. But there's ways
Right.
we can deal with it. The building codes, the Galveston seawall, and so forth. We're dealing with it.
Yeah, and I think people just have to keep that in context and understand. You got to look at the data because I think there's some people out there that are just hell-bent on just saying, "Oh no, there's more. They're bigger and they're more fierce." And come on, give us a break. Just go look at the data. Start there and then form a valid conclusion that you can support with facts and data. And that's the key thing. Some people conflate, obviously, their opinions with fact as well these days, misconstrue those two words. But back to what you said, I commend the state of Florida for taking a beating literally every year. I commend the Caribbean islands for taking a beating literally every year. And I commend them for their economic activity to try to generate economic wealth for an island nation to be able to withstand those annual beatings or biannual, whatever happens. That the frequencies, Judy, better than I do as far as the Caribbean impacts. But they have to adjust their economic models as well because they don't have a lot of space. They constantly get beat up, and you have to think about that. And it's not a true, large landform where you have the other benefits. They just don't get those benefits as an island nation. It's pretty clear. When you look at Florida, though, people are always screaming whenever there's a hurricane. Oh, the commercial reactors are going to have a problem. There's going to be a meltdown. I always hear that every time there's a hurricane that hits Florida, and it's just the same old nonsense, right? One of the other things I think people have to keep in context on this too is economic damage is very subjective in the sense that, as you said, the big hurricane that hit Miami in the past. That's also, I think people have to look at it from that context and understand that, of course, the economic damage is going to be bigger today. And then just because the hurricane's a Cat 5 or a Cat 4, the rainfall quantities could vary depending on the size of that Cat 4 or that Cat 5, and that it's not necessarily the storm size that may have more rainfall. In my experience, and I've been in a few of them in Central America 2020, that wasn't the case. The smaller, larger storm in terms of size carried more rain than the Cat 5 storm that followed after it.
Yeah, apart from, people think category five, and all this kind of thing. But apart from the intensity, the peak wind speed, it's the horizontal extent, like you mentioned, that scales with the amount of rain and the storm surge. But the other thing is how fast the storm is moving. A slow-moving storm causes a lot more damage than a fast-moving storm. The slow-moving storm allows more water to pile up from the storm surge and also sits, delivers more rain to a given location if it's moving slowly. So when we look at damage, my company has a damage metric that we use that relates to intensity, the maximum wind speed, the horizontal extent, and the forward speed of motion, three factors that are going to contribute to the damage.
Might have to start contacting you, Judy, to get my forecast and stop using the NHC to get the prediction. So I appreciate that. In the past, Judy's group has received funding from government agencies as part of their work because of their modeling and their proprietary information, how they put together these predictions and these patterns, and obviously the data for clients. So, okay, I want to just for the sake of time, because I know we're short of time and we're going to have to, of course, have you back and talk more subjects, but I want to move into just a few other topics here and then we'll talk just a little bit of CO2 before we wrap up. But Judy, in your opinion, has climate change resulted in increased turbulence for airplanes?
No. Okay, there's three different types of turbulence that an airplane can encounter. One is just in the vicinity of mountain ranges, like I live in Reno, Nevada, and if you come in for a landing, it's going to be bumping. You always have these orographic waves, turbulence associated with the mountains. The other source is convective, thunderstorms, deep convective towers. And then the third type is clear air turbulence. So, in terms of are any of these related to global warming? The mountain one, definitely not. The thunderstorms, there's no evidence of an increase in thunderstorm activity. There is a paper that argues that clear air turbulence, and this is up, 7 miles in the atmosphere, where jets fly around 40,000 feet, that there is an argument for increasing clear air turbulence in the vicinity of the jet stream, which is a mid-latitude thing that you see over the US and in the North Atlantic. So you can imagine that that's the big flight track between the US and Europe. So, I mean, there's a big chain of reasoning and a lot of indirect things, to come up with this idea. So I can't say that it's true or not. I mean, it's just too indirect and we don't have good enough data. But if you look at the data from the number in terms of over the continental US from the aviation authorities, the number of incidents reported by pilots, that are related to turbulence. Since 1988, I think they have good records. There's no trend at all. I mean, you see some years where there's fewer or less, but there's no trend at all of turbulence related reports over the continental US. And this is in spite of the fact that the number of flights has increased since 1988. So we don't seem to be seeing any kind of an increase in turbulent aircraft turbulence over the US.
Very interesting. You have different factors, of course. Now you've got, you could suggest that pilot competence plays into this to some degree. You mentioned, obviously, the record should be pretty clear on this because it should be actually very, very well established data because these aircraft are obviously so well tracked and there's so much data that's recorded off of them as far as altitudes and all these other data that comes in, different metrics that come into these that are tracked almost essentially in real time. And then also, just the fact that just like life insurance industry, life insurance industry knows so well the life expectancy of humans, period. There's no other group, doctor, what have you, that knows life expectancy better than the life insurance industry, pretty cut and dried. And so I think that's similar. And if you're saying basically that there isn't any notable trend being established, that right now there's not enough information to say that there's actually, you can blame it on climate change, but yeah, it's kind of a scapegoat, as you know. It gets constantly blamed for something. But there's other things like incompetence, and then also airline quality, Judy, seems to be, and I'm not talking about the operators, I'm talking about the makers. At least one of them seems to be on the decline as well. So at least from a quality control standpoint. But another topic for another podcast. But anyway, I really appreciate the discussion on that and how you see that, because that's obviously been brought up recently as well. I'd like to touch on CO2 for a moment, and we'll just touch on this before we wrap up. And of course, we'll come back at another time and talk more about it. But I'd like to understand, and I think this is important for the audience as well, because I don't know near as much as you, and I'm still a person that's studying this stuff every day and having to evaluate this when I have time. But can you give us just Give us maybe start somewhere, either at ground level or up at space level, and break down for us the percentages of the important gases or the gases within the various layers of atmosphere. Maybe remind me, forgive me for my lack of education in university, the different types of atmospheres, the gases within, and where CO2 falls into each of these layers. And of course, down to the everyday oxygen air that we breathe.
Let's look at what we call the troposphere. This is the layer of the atmosphere between the surface and about 40,000 feet. Okay, and for the a lot of the gases are well mixed. Just from turbulence and thunderstorms and whatever, they get mixed because of the wind speeds. So gases like oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, they're well mixed in this layer. Water vapor is different because it gets involved in cloud processes and it condenses and stuff like that. So that's not a well mixed gas in the way that the others are. So, okay, the most abundant gas is nitrogen, 79%, and oxygen next at about 19%, and all the other gases just fill in a few percent. Carbon dioxide is like 0.04%. It's a trace gas. But the reason, so why do we even care about carbon dioxide? Well, gases like nitrogen don't influence, there's no greenhouse effect associated. It doesn't have infrared emission spectra, whereas carbon dioxide and water vapor do. So these are much more radiatively important gases. So CO2 is important radiatively, even though it's a trace gas. And CO2 has natural sources, from volcanoes, the ocean, human respiration, I mean, fossil fuel burning of wood, there's all sorts of sources of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so humans have added to the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere through emissions. So, I mean, a relatively small amount, but it disrupts the balance. Yeah, animals take up carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide really acts as fertilizer for plants. So plants provide a carbon sink. In fact, satellite observations since 1980 show that the planet has greened because of the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So plants uptake carbon dioxide, and the more carbon dioxide, for the most part, the better for plants. You don't hear that one very often.
So animals, like including humans, would not only utilize it, but also emit it too.
Yeah, I mean, humans eat plants, and then they, part of their respiration, their exhalation, they emit CO2. I mean, and if you're in, say, a closed room, like a classroom, with like 40 people or something like that, the carbon dioxide, if the windows are closed, will get to be, 1 to 2 orders of magnitude larger than the ambient atmosphere. Okay, and we're breathing in those high levels of carbon dioxide, and it doesn't cause us any problem at all. So, high levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are not a problem for humans, and plants happen to like it. But the issue is the warming. Okay, there is a, like I said, the infrared emission spectra does act to warm the planet, the surface of the planet. How much? Scientists disagree. How much of this warming matters relative to natural climate variability? Scientists disagree on that.
Was there anything else about the layers that you wanted to mention before we just wrap
Well,
up on
not
this?
really. Yeah, I think the layering idea, I mean, if you just look at, take, let's just worry about the troposphere, the 40,000 feet layer. That's the one we live in, we fly in, we do everything in. So carbon
Okay.
dioxide is pretty well mixed.
The ones above it, and of course with the sun.
Well, the stratus, yeah, that's where the ozone lives. Those aren't unimportant, but carbon dioxide isn't much of a player.
Okay, because of course ozone was a big thing in the past, of course, with CFCs and these types of things. Yeah, Judy, it's interesting because, as you said, we exhale larger quantities of CO2 than we inhale under normal circumstances. You gave the classroom analogy. You have to take some significant interest in this, and you have to question the overarching narrative that's being perpetrated on this CO2 issue. As you said, it's a trace gas. It's a tasteless gas. I can't see it, at least with the bare human eye, and I can't smell it either. So it's just a perfect vehicle. It's almost like a you have to take it on faith that it's there. Obviously, we know it's there because of scientific experiment, but for the normal person, you have to question. There's enough holes in the narrative that you have to investigate those holes. And as you investigate those holes, it becomes more apparent that there's even more holes in the narrative. So really appreciate that bit. Well, Judy, I think for the sake of time here, I think we'll stop there. Of course, we want to continue the conversation. Hope you'll come back. Final question for you as we wrap up here, and I really appreciate you giving us an hour. Best way for people that are interested in your work and then want to hire your firm to, or at least receive proposals from your firm for some of their issues that obviously can result in economic benefit for them, what's the best way for those parties to reach out to you?
My company is Climate Forecast Applications Network. The website is cfanclimate.net. You can go to also my blog, judithcurry.com. It has some contact information there. And for background, you can read my book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk. And if you're on Twitter, follow me at CurryJA.
Excellent. I definitely encourage the audience, even if you're not interested in hiring Judy to provide services to you. The book, I think, is a very good starting point to go get. I'm sure it's widely available out there for folks to grab. Check in on that. Judy, really appreciate the time here. Always great to speak with you. We hope you'll come back again soon.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.